to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me this evening, everybody's favorite lawyer that, well, maybe now everybody's second favorite, no wait, I forgot about Jimmy McGill. Everybody's third favorite lawyer, it's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm realizing that when we record our podcast, I need to leave the AC on until the very last second. Because it's been a hot, sweltering couple days here in New York, and I've had the AC on in this room all this time, but I must have turned it off about, I don't know, 15 minutes ago, and it feels like I turned it off 50 hours ago right now. It's like I'm already having beads of sweat rolling down my nose and such. So, you know, I'm in New York, but it certainly feels like hot LA right
now. It's been hot here, too, and, you know, I'm sure air conditioning units everywhere are working overtime. It's been a hot one the last few days.
Oh, yeah. I'm imagining it's the entire East Coast region, or maybe even most of the country. I haven't really checked out weather reports. It seems like I don't watch the weather as much as of late. Interesting. Don't know what that means. Anyway, no one really cares. So we are here to talk about the latest chapter of Perry Mason. Chapter 5 was tonight. I've been neglecting to see, to check out the writer and director of the episodes. Because I know Tim Van Patten was directing the first couple. I don't know if he's been directing all of them or not. Have you been paying attention to the credits?
He's directed several of them, and his name was in the credits tonight. But I was kind of losing steam at the end and wanting to hurry up and prepare so we could do the podcast. So I didn't pay the attention I usually do. To see if it was just as an executive producer or if he directed.
Right. It just occurred to me because I know in the past when I've podcasted about shows like, you know, like Better Call Saul, for example, I usually lead off by saying who the writer and directors were, you know, whether it's someone who's affiliated with the show or whatever. So I'm just, while I'm yapping for a moment, I'm actually just going to look because I'm just curious, especially because of how well put together this show tends to be. Okay, it is a different director. The director was some... Oh, look at her. Denise Gamzee Erguven. It's a U at two U's. I probably mispronounced that. She's done some interesting indie or sort of foreign films. Well, she's directed episodes of Handmaid's Tale. Oh, good for her. Oh, cool. Anyway, and the writer, I'm sure, is probably the co-creators and different people like that. Anyway, let's get to the episode because... as we said last week, we were looking forward to this episode. I think we look forward to every episode, but we were looking forward to what they were going to do now that EB had clearly died at the end of Chapter 4. So we can kick off right with that. By the way, right off the bat, and probably why I was wondering who the director was, because it was just such a nice little gag they did at the beginning. I just loved that image of Della standing like, within the title credit card that way. I really got a kick out of that. You know, the three-dimensionality of it all is really kind of nice. I will also say at the same point, you know, wouldn't she have smelled the gas practically the moment she walked in? It seemed like it took a while for her to be aware of what had happened. Maybe I'm nitpicking. I'm sure I am. But the thought had occurred to me. But we did get that confirmation right off the bat. Oh, he's dead. He's definitely dead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in not wasting any time right back into the story, I had the same thought. And I also was thinking, you know, if the gas had been on that long, how long could she walk through the house before she would, you know, pass out or right. become ill? And but, you know, I mean, minor.
Right.
It's a minor thing.
It's one of those things where you kind of, especially the way I've been discussing the show and saluting the fact that, you know, we're dealing with territory and storylines and a genre which is very open to, I don't know if open's the right word, way to put it, it's known for any number of cliches. It just is. Just like a, you know, just like a Western would be and so on. And here you expect her to walk in and to be aware of it right off the bat, you know, put a handkerchief to her face, throw open a window, that whole thing. Because that's just what you do. And that's the thing we've seen a million times before. And the fact that she didn't do it, it's like, oh, they didn't do that. But it's like, but wouldn't she have noticed it right off the bat? But again, it's, I'm not really critiquing the show. It's just more of a curiosity. But I did write it down as a note, so I guess there was that. Now, obviously, you know, it's pretty obvious because we see it 5 seconds later. First person she calls is Perry Mason, and I'm going to check the box. I don't know if it's just me. You can tell me. When it comes to giving into my emotions, as far as my tear ducts are concerned, I'm an easy touch when it comes to TVs and film. It seems like it doesn't really take much to get me going. I've been embarrassed many times watching something with someone else, and they can actually hear me kind of getting a little choky sounding. You know, they hear that little clicking. I'm trying to restrain myself, whatever. The moment when Perry Mason shows up at the door and she, you know, breaks down and falls in, you know, and hugs him, whatever, was the first of a few times in the episode where I got a little choked up.
Yeah, I thought it was very effective the way that she was the focal point of it. And you and I discussed, we thought that would be the appropriate way to handle it. Because she picks him up, she's there in the morning. And to just so I don't forget later, I'll go ahead and say, and the thought I had watching it later was enunciated by Perry when he says, you know, that was sort of a crappy thing to do to you, that, you know, EB trusted her so much that he knew she'd take care of everything. And, right. And, you know, which I think shows his confidence in her capability, but also is kind of a crappy thing to do to somebody.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it kind of, to one extent, it does go hand in hand when the kind of things we say about someone after they've killed themselves is it's a rare instance indeed where it doesn't end up being kind of a shitty thing to do to at least one, if not more, people in that person's life. Whether, right. Whether it be the people you leave behind, the person who's going to find you, the person who has to deal with all the situations that are going to, the consequences of what you did, you know, that is one of, not the only, but one of the many reasons sometimes people refer to suicide being a very selfish act is because, you know, because you don't care about the consequences it's going to have for everyone else and how they're going to have to deal with it. Maybe you care, but your desire to end it all supersedes that. There are people who can speak much more eloquently on that topic than I can, for sure. But that's just my take on it. What I thought was really interesting, and it had not. It's among the list of things that, you know, I see in this episode that I was a little upset with myself not having seen it coming or not anticipated it would have to be done. The fact that they relocate his body and basically remove any evidence, so to speak, that he had actually killed himself, and making it appear more that he had died in bed and that it would be more of a situation where, you know, insurance could be collected and so on. But it really seemed to be, I mean, I know they make a mention of the insurance a couple times throughout it, but I also thought it was more trying to save his reputation and his legacy, which we would all agree had already started getting a bit tarnished in the last few days, which is quite frankly what led to him killing himself.
Yeah, and we learn later in the episode, I think it's probably really important for both of their careers as well that he not be as tarnished in death and be followed by scandal.
Right.
Because if there's a chance of that office to continue and her work and, you know, and we learn finally, I mean, you know, Perry has studied under him, that it would kind of be a bad thing to both of them if he died under such terrible circumstances. But I did think it was, talking about the way this show plays with film noir, you know, the idea of protecting the insurance or doing something for insurance, you know, we get that in there, and we've seen that in film noir before. And I thought the thing that was peculiar about it at first, until we learned later, finally got the answer to our, you know, one of our big questions, was why would Della be so protective of the insurance when clearly it was going to his family and his son, And at first I thought maybe she was just, you know, a really good person. And I think she is a good person. I don't mean to discount that, but I think we see later there, you know, there may have been some more self-interested motives for doing it as well. So,
All right. Well, when we get to that, you'll have to, it's that what you're saying is not quite clicking in my head right now, but maybe when we get to that part,
okay,
it'll materialize. Yeah. There are certain things I'm deliberately not mentioning right now because once I start talking about them, that's going to be the whole thing. So I'm just
that's why I'm trying to be vague.
I gotcha. I think we all know, you know, plus I'm going to have to talk about how wrong I was. So that's okay. I can be right about things and I can be wrong. So yes, we get the stuff with the insurance guy. We get them. I love them taking the train and bringing the body to the final resting place. Putting aside, you know, the blow-by-blow events of the episode, I do want to say that we get one of the reasons I really like this episode a lot. And by the way, I really like this episode a lot. There are so many great little scenes, interactions, dialogue between characters in this episode. Some of them are more obvious than others that would come to mind. Obviously, Perry and Della, that we're going to get to fairly soon. But, you know, even stuff like it could be Detective Ennis and Pete. Great scene. Or, you know, even stuff with Sister Alice. And I haven't been the biggest Sister Alice cheerleader this season beyond acknowledging, you know, the worthiness of the performance. I do feel now she is, I am more attuned to the character and the part she's playing in the series right now than I was maybe a couple episodes ago. So I just want to say this because it's just, there's great forward movement and momentum in this episode but it doesn't short you on character stuff. There's so many good little dialogue scenes and little bits of backstory dribbled in here and there, and then you start wondering what characters actually do or don't know about each other. Again, we're gonna get to that stuff. Let me see what else we got here. They actually cut away from a lot of stuff to a lot of the other things that are going on in the episode, which we can kind of, depending how you feel, how much time we can spend on it. Like, say, the Sister Alice stuff. Before we get to Emily Dodson appearing, but when she's dealing with the church board, you know, all the letters and the donations and the death threats and whatever, do you feel she's truly convinced that she can actually raise this child from the dead?
I think we saw either a crack in her performance or self-doubt of someone who genuinely believes that in this episode. But we do see for the first time her sort of snap back and show an iron will towards her mother with everyone in the room to say, you know, this is how I want something to be and this is how it's going to be.
Right.
So I'm, you know, I wonder if that this is going to be the transition of her character from, you know, sort of the figurehead to maybe the central figure in that church. As we also learn, the church is, you know, now possibly facing a division and a schism that plays out on the front steps.
Well, yeah, it has because Elder Brown, I guess his name is, who was pretty much one of the main guys on the board, has fractured and left and is now opposing her. I mean, he's literally holding a rally right outside.
Yes.
You know, in opposition to her. It's interesting how many things happen in this episode, and this episode taking place in 1932, and you start getting these eerie feelings about just stuff that's going on in the world today, whether it be, you know, the black congregation debate that was going on and people trying to stand up for their rights or whatever. And this is 1932, and you get really depressed when you realize it's 2020 right now. And obviously things have changed, but they also haven't changed enough.
Or, right.
And now you're also getting, you know, things that, you know, a church board that was in unison that kind of fractures, it's not much different than a political party that kind of fractures within itself and then runs in opposition to each other. So that kind of plays out that way. And the fact you do have games that are being played, you know, with lawyers and assigned lawyers and whatever, where people are doing things that are purely more out of political gain than anything else. And God, Lord knows you can probably apply such thinking to any number of things that we've seen in the world, or should I say in this country, over the last year. And I'm not getting onto either side of the political aisle here. I'm just saying, but it's hard not to be aware of that. So
just thought. No, I mean, I really thought as I watched this episode and it started, I really wondered where it was going after EB, and it really just in drips and drabs continued the forward momentum. And I thought, you know, the beauty of the story is I was a little disappointed there wasn't something more for EB and when we just shifted towards the train. But then when he got home and you learn, you know, to receive such a reception from your family and the son not to even bother to bring the kids from school and to say he's joining, you know, did he ever talk about my mother? Now he's going to go in there beside her. You know, there's an awful lot of story in that short interaction that that tells you a lot and informs right. Perry on Perry's path, I think, of what seems to be to try to find some redemption.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you hit it right on the head. If they had played that out where his body arrives in, I guess, the San Francisco area or somewhere near San Francisco, and there had been your usual mourners and, you know, his son and grandkids, whatever, all there and whatever, they would have been, okay, yeah, but we wouldn't have given it another thought. Not really. Just having the son show up and the way he acts and the way he speaks. And by the way, he sounds so much like his dad.
Mm-hmm.
The guy nailed the voice. If he was trying to get, you know, Lithgow's voice with that accent, he nailed it. You know, I thought it really sounded like his dad. It's economy of storytelling. And we end up finding out and learning so much more from this rather minor interaction. It's much more interesting, but it's also much more tragic as well, which kind of goes hand in hand with the whole story to begin with. The fact that EB kills himself is tragic. The fact that what's been going on the last couple of days and how he's been faltering and his health and everything else. Tragic, tragic, tragic. I mean, basically, that's the first half of the season has been the tragic story of E.B. Jonathan, quite frankly.
Right.
But then when we cut from that to that first night between Della and Perry, and you had already mentioned the thing that Perry had said about, you know, that was kind of a horrible thing that he did, you know, kind of just leaving it to her to find, because she knew she would find him and, you know, arrange things or whatever. But I thought there was a lot of fun, interesting, insightful stuff in this little scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because at this point, with these two characters, it occurs to me that we kind of know more about him than her. I mean, we know a little bit about her, and we certainly know a little bit about what's, you know, at least one of her secrets as far as, you know, the other border, where she's staying and stuff. But I like that we got a very shorthand but quick exposition on her in a way that made perfect sense, because Perry was kind of showing his own intuition and deductive skills, and then we find out, yeah, you know, she did come for money, but she pretty much renounced it when she left home because it was an arranged fiance and they wouldn't let her go to college or what have you. And again, it might have been said in that previous episode. Was it the last episode? It had to be the last episode. And I just didn't hear it correct. I just didn't catch on to it. I didn't realize from the previous episode that Lyle was actually his former partner. I didn't make that I'm sure I just didn't hear the line that kind of told me that. I don't know if you knew that last week.
I didn't know it. But based on the interaction that they had and the discussions that occurred, I think it's not unlikely.
Although they confirm he was his partner here, so that...
Yeah.
My assumption is, I don't know if I kept my notes from last week, but my assumption is I didn't pick up on that. If it turns out I did say it, yay, but I don't think I did. I'm pretty sure I did.
I don't think it was explicit in that conversation. I think it was more implied. Right. But Della... In looking at Della and Perry, what I love about their interaction is you have two people who both have a lot of pain and secrets that are hidden from the world. And in that interaction, they sort of joust with each other about that. But Della's the one that wants Perry to be the better version of himself. And Perry certainly appreciates Della, but he's sort of wallowing in a certain degree of self-destruction that she points out. And I thought that was really, I thought she didn't hit him over the head, but she gave him the nudge maybe he needed.
Well, if I had been Perry, I will give him credit for the way he reacted to her during the scene, because she does have that part where she says that she finds it offensive that he masks his decency and intelligence with cynicism and slothfulness. I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Slothfulness? we want to rewind back that word. But it actually made me realize, and not that I hadn't assumed this already, but I think it just made it more clear to me. Those little bits we know about Perry's backstory, specifically what he went through in the war and whatever, I don't think she knows.
Right.
I don't think she has any awareness. Again, does that mean she wouldn't say these things? Probably not. She'd probably still say it. You know, it wasn't like it was 2 weeks ago. It was, 16, 17, whatever number. Not 17, but you know what I mean. 14 years ago. The other thing that I'm just trying to... I had something else interesting here. Oh, I guess I was trying to determine what Perry meant when he referred to E.B. and he said he was living a lie. But I think I understand it. I understood it like a minute after I wrote it down, because like I wrote it with a question mark. He was living a lie. And then I realized, considering the situation E.B. was left in by the end of this and the front he always had put up, yeah, I believe he kind of was living a lie, especially then in terms of his family and the pictures, whatever, his family knows he clearly never really had much of any contact with them. At least that was the way I took it.
Well, it was left ambiguous, and you could make another inference that perhaps is why his family stayed away, and why the son was upset about the fact that he was going to end up being in there with his mother when maybe there was something else. Maybe he lived in the city, and because they also say he's a very private man. So I mean, it's purposefully ambiguous.
Yes.
He could have been a lie, quote unquote, in many ways, and in both those ways, but both those ways you take it, each facet of that is either Della or Perry.
That's very true. It's very true. Very true.
So if you want to look at the lies each of them are living and what they're doing, it could play out perfectly. And to that end, I think that's why I've liked what the writing has done. It's really given you a lot without giving you the let's just have exposition. I think that was a wonderful scene. Capped him off and sent them off on this new journey.
Right. And I think the trick is, and whether we choose to appreciate it or not, is when you do things like that, when you do things to leave things deliberately ambiguous in that sense, and I love you pointing out how there is probably certain aspects of EB which may even I'm actually going to use words you didn't use, but I think this is what you were meaning anyway. They kind of reflected and those the two that are closest to him, you know, is, you know, the two who have a, probably have the strongest connection to him, which would be Perry and Della, as far as secrets, as far as living a lie. And that the moment I hear the phrase living a lie, I know the first thing that you, when you hear that phrase, I know the first thing you think. At least I know the first thing I think. And the more I thought about it, and even during this podcast, I'm like going, yeah, you know, I could kind of see that playing some sort of part. You know, it's like the unspoken thing, you know, it's especially for the 1930s. I mean, oof, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That really makes a heck of a lot of sense. So, but let me cut out of this and move on with Perry a little further. You know, we get past the probably a bit of momentary confusion of why did Perry leave and get in the truck with these migrant workers, you know, before Della could show up. And then we learn it's because he's going to see, well, it's because he wants to see his son, but we meet his ex-wife. And then we get, hey, look, another amazing Boardwalk Empire connection by it's Gretchen Mom.
Yeah.
You know, as his ex-wife, Linda, who, and first, it took me a second. I kept thinking, it looks like Gretchen Mol, but yet it doesn't. Is it? It's gotta be Gretchen Mol, right? And I just quickly looked at IMDb. Nope, that's her. And I was like, all right, she looks a bit more matronly than the last time we saw her, but all right. Just a detail before we get to the little bit of what that scene's really about. I'm assuming, because it's not expressly said, I'm just guessing who people are. My guess is she living with her sister? And I'm assuming Cheryl is her sister and Ed's Cheryl's husband. Is that?
My guess is, what I took from that scene, is that probably when Perry got her pregnant to avoid scandal, she moved in with her sister and they've taken care of her and the boy ever since. And that's how I took it to be.
Oh, I thought because I thought they were divorced. I thought they were married and divorced.
I got the impression when he said, "How many times did I ask you to marry me, and you always said no." Huh. Now you know, I just finished watching it, so maybe I misheard, but I got the impression. My take on this was that she got pregnant. He didn't have it all together. She wouldn't marry him, so she went to live with some family member who I assume was her sister. And I just want to compliment the acting in that scene to go against type. That when the man walks in and you hear his voice and you expect there to be conflict, and the dude walks in and says, "Come on, stay, have dinner." I thought that was delightful to show. And you also see he has a connection with Perry's son that you know, just the way he's holding him, you know, there standing in the kitchen, that you can tell there's genuine affection. And I think, you know, Perry sees that this is a good, you know, it's a good setup for his son, and looks back on what he could have had and didn't. And, I really liked it when he was in the truck. I wasn't sure what was going on, and when this happened, it kind of shocked me. But it was a nice diversion, and I think Della's nudge led to this, which sort of started the dominoes falling towards him. I mean, if he learned anything from EB and EB's life, I think it was that he didn't want, you know, his son standing at a mausoleum saying, "My dad was a piece of shit." Right. So,
no, absolutely. Obviously, it's a borderline knee jerk reaction to what has happened with EB and how we saw what happens with EB and his family. I mean, it doesn't need to be subtle. It's kind of obvious. And there's nothing wrong with that, because not everything that's life. Everything I'm reading, by the way, because in case you heard me tippy-tapping on the keyboard while you were speaking, and I'll probably come through on the podcast, because these super sensitive microphones. I was just checking a few things. Everything I'm reading and different things indicates that she is, that he is separated from his wife, Linda. So or ex-wife. So that's how she's being referred to in everything I'm reading here. So I'm going to stick with that until I hear otherwise. So if it's good enough for the New York Times, it's good enough for me as well.
Hey, you know, look, we don't do research. We do instant reaction. Oh, yeah, and I could be wrong.
Oh, hey, it would not shock me if it turned out you were right and all these other things were wrong, because we had just been going about it assuming that was the case. And it's clear I might have missed the bits of dialogue that you caught. I just, in my own mind, I kept going, no, I'm pretty sure, because she's acting more like a wife or ex-wife does about the money, rather than just, you know, an ex-girlfriend with a kid and just wanting money for the kid. Sure. It seemed like it was more, I mean, not to put it in the most obvious thing possible, but it seemed more alimony related than just pure, you know, send some money for the kid kind of a thing. But anyway, that's just the way I took it. Oh my God, it's gotten so hot in this room right now. All right, so I'm going to skip that. But anyway.
But another great scene.
Great scene. It was, and again, it was really nice to see Gretchen Mol in this. Someone who I will tell you right now, I had a bit of an aversion to in the early goings of Boardwalk Empire, but by the time Boardwalk Empire ended, I really liked her and her character. I didn't like her initially, but as the series wore on, she grew on me. And maybe it's because I just got to know her character more, or the tragic nature of her character. Is that word tragic? That should be the, you know, say the secret word, get $25 for the podcast. Tragic. Check the box. That moment when we see Perry hugging his son outside for a really long, that was the second bit that got me a little verklempt. So just
one. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just bouncing briefly, because just it happens in the order of the episode, but was more, I don't know if you would know, because it might be more of a 1930s thing. I did not, we kind of bounce back over to Sister Alice when she's obviously bailed out Emily Dodson, and the detectives are dropping Emily off with Sister Alice and her mom. That seemed really strict, the way that was handled. But I don't know if that's maybe it's because it's such a high-profile special case, or that's just the way things were done in the 1930s, or is this just more evidence of the corruption that's going on between these detectives and everything else, and, you know, with the police? It just seemed weird for me, like they would bring her all the way there, still in her handcuffs, whatever. And I wasn't so weirded out that the detective would be reading off all the things that she can or can't do, but it was just, I didn't know you'd have to be in freaking irons until, you know, you set foot on the property. So it seemed a bit extreme, but maybe that's the way things were done. I'm not sure which is the right answer for that one.
I don't know how it was done then. Typically when you post bail, you're released and you know, like, my guess is, though, from all the political notoriety that this case obviously is generating in that universe, that this was a show to both tell Sister Alice and the world that, you know, she was still a dangerous person and they were going to be watching her and they were just waiting for her to make a mistake.
Right. I agree. And I know you really cover. I feel you already covered the previous scene between Perry and Linda, the woman that was in his life. We'll just say it that way then.
His ex, whatever that means.
His ex. We'll say his ex, and you know, you'll say gal pal. I'll say wife. But I did like the fact that although initially it seems like it was about her not approving of his chosen profession, it's really, that's just emblematic of everything that was wrong between them. And much like any divide that happens to a couple, things are rarely come down to a simple explanation and a simple, it was this or it was that. It's usually, you know, it's a cacophony of things, you know. And if he, even though Perry can be fun, we've seen it, but we also see that Perry can also not be fun. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how much patience or toleration, you know, a wife or girlfriend would have with that over the long haul. I mean, Luby's just dealing with it because she wants to buy the goddamn farm anyway.
Right.
We should also, because I mentioned it super briefly before, we were just talking about how it's reflecting current events in this episode. Maybe talk a bit about the Drakes at this point.
Yeah, a lot of exposition about the Drakes.
Right. So, I mean, everyone who watched the episode, we know, you have the debate scene, you have the, including post-debate conversation, which is very telling. We already kind of knew this about her, about Drake's wife. It becomes more disturbing here. And then with what happens at the beach later on, where we see, the fact that he's a cop from LA and this is Santa Monica, guess what? It wouldn't have mattered if this was a beach in LA. I don't think that would have mattered. I think that cop would have been the same exact way. And then eventually when we get to them in bed together. So we see the throw line of what's going on with them. And the only thing I will say, I shouldn't say the only thing, because I found it all very interesting and fascinating. I was happy to see that by the end of it, at least the end of the succession of scenes, that the white, that what's her, like, they gave her name. I'm keep forgetting what her name is. It begins with an E. Like, not Edna or Edwina. Can't remember what it is. Sorry, guys. I should have written it down. I keep writing the Drakes. I don't refer to them by their first names. I'll give her credit for realizing and admitting that she was wrong. And because the way she has been, I didn't think she was going to make that change. Even with what happened on the beach. But I was glad to see her realizing she was wrong, especially the effect and impact it's having on her husband.
Yeah. So I thought the indignity, of what he had to suffer, it has to suffer at work constantly, and then seeing a police officer say that, and I'll give her credit probably more than most, because I think her speaking up for his, what he does, to say, look, we're he's a police officer, and seeing it made no difference at all, probably softened her to where when they were in bed together, she could understand why he was so upset. She even tried to diffuse the situation, and there was no diffusing it. But I mean, man, when he's laying in that bed, like his face, you can just see the rage and the anger, and it was really well played.
What I thought was fascinating about it was, if he was merely seething about what happened at the beach, it would be one thing. He's not.
Right.
He's not.
Right.
He's seething about, yes, he's angry about what happened at the beach. Of course it is. He's seething about what she said after the debate. That's what he's quoting about the render unto Caesar and, not fighting, that whole thing. That's what that's what he kind of spits back at her, so to speak. And the fact that she takes it and she realizes what she did and what she said, it just, after seeing what happened out on the beach, you put those two together. Oh, now I understand. Now maybe we do have to do, maybe, people do have to do something if they're going to make a change. I hate to tell her it's going to be a while, but
yeah, and you see her trying to sort of maybe push him towards leaving the police force and getting a truck and doing that, and but it was a nice ending for her to realize where he was and how he felt, and to say, whatever you decide to do, I'm going to support you. And so I thought that was a nice ending to that sort of storyline.
Well, one of the things I'm enjoying about the series is definitely, having some memory or acknowledgement of, who these characters were in, an old TV show or the books, whatever, is, this is everybody's origin. It's not just Perry Mason's.
Right.
And, it's because there are at least five running characters throughout all the Perry Mason stories, especially if you watch the TV show, and I believe they're all in the original books as well. And, we've been experiencing up until we're experiencing three of them, We do, and we are going to get to a fourth. I'm so excited. But not there yet. But I do love, you know, we go from speaking of lawyers, and we weren't, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. You know, Matt Malloy, he really plays the Frank Dillon character. That was the lawyer we saw skulking out of the bathroom when Barnes wanted some private time with the detectives. I think it was two episodes ago. I don't think it was the last episode. I think it was the one before that.
I think that's right.
I can't remember now. The chapter's all blurred just like a book. I don't know what happened in chapter two to chapter three. I don't know. Anyway, what I thought was interesting, first of all, the fact he's eating cake in that whole scene with Sister Alice and Emily, whatever, I thought was such a nice little character touch. Because I was like, that's telling me more than anything he's going to say right now.
Yes.
I love, and the fact, just the fact it's a fancy cake, too. Because if you look at it, it wasn't just like some common slab of pie or whatever. It looks like it's got a little bit of pink to it and white. You know, it looks like it could be like wedding cake. But what I thought was interesting initially was, okay, it's not when we first get the indication, oh, the court has assigned a lawyer. Your first thought, of course, once again, you know, it's the usual cliche. It's like, oh, it's going to be some incompetent or someone who just totally doesn't care and just wants to plead it out, period, kind of a guy. And then initially, like, oh, no, that's not the kind of guy this is. And they're like, oh, it's far more insidious than that.
Yeah, it's it twists that into, I mean, everything feeds into corruption on this show. And yet, even the most basic right of this woman, now that EB is dead, is something that the DA corrupts. And we've seen there's nothing the DA won't corrupt.
Oh, yeah. He's if it wasn't for the fact that Detective Ennis has actually murdered people, Barnes is the true villain of this show so far. The other guy's actually killed people, but you know, murders aside, Barnes feels like the villain of the show.
But let me say, based on the phone call between Dillon and the DA in the office that Dell overhears,
yep,
it's still possible he was in on it. My theory still lives.
That's true.
Because he's trying to find out what Perry knows. Now, he could, you know, it's entirely true, too, that he could just be trying to see what the case is like to prepare his prosecution. But, you know, that there's some real insidious steps. And I think what maybe is the most telling thing about this whole case and everything that's happened is when Lyle tells Della, like, it's a dog loser. Like it's a predetermined loser case.
Preordained loser.
Yes. Like that all the powerful people know this lady's going down.
Right. Absolutely. Because when there's a super high profile case, no matter what era it is, whether it be the 30s or the 90s or whatever, there's usually going to be any number of lawyers who want to jump on it, even if the odds aren't great that you'll win, because it's a super high profile case. You know, you can make your bones on that. You can even make a great showing for yourself, even if you do lose, you know, depending on the nature of the case. This one's got more, there's more going on here.
It's, yes.
No one wants to go anywhere near it. And Barnes is using this as his platform and his springboard to something bigger. Like, I believe they've probably mentioned it in the episode. I can't remember now because it's late and it's hot in this room. But I think he's looking at this as a possible springboard for higher political office, which would be, you know, like, say, governor or something. Do they say that in the episode, or am I just imagining that? I feel like they say it somewhere.
There's a hint of it. I don't remember if it was said explicitly, because it's also echoed with the deputy who approaches Perry that Della reaches out to. Because, yeah, you know,
I'm not going there yet. That's my most exciting thing in the entire episode. So that's why I'm not going there yet. But yes, again, everything is political. You're right. Everything is political. I think everyone looks at things as a way, you know, up and around. Even whether it be someone doing something that's truly kind of, you know, I don't know if evil is the right word, but clearly corrupt. I mean, being someone's lawyer, but you're going to supply the opposition with all their information well ahead of time, just so they can be sure that they, you know, there are no surprises. You know, he's not doing it in terms of being ethical. He's doing it at the guy's behest, and so on. But let's get to the scene then when Perry shows up at the office. That's a great scene.
And absolutely.
Yeah, it's. I love Perry cracking up when he walks in, and then I love that he's literally throwing the book at the guy.
Yeah.
In fact, many books at him. And basically runs him out. I love the thread. Like I know people. I know people downtown. And it's like, ooh, downtown.
Well, and the hilarious symbolism of throwing a Tolstoy book and then literally choking the guy, a lawyer with a law book. I mean, it was a great scene. Perry's anger rising and getting more and more indignant, and this sort of, you know, feeds off into his rant. Where he's getting worked up by seeing what's happened.
Well, yes. What I would say, because I'm parceling this out for this episode, there is a really nice progression with Perry's character throughout the episode.
Yes,
and it's I apologize if I sound in any way. What's the word? Not pompous. I can't think of it right now. It's funny. I was about to talk about being a writer, and I can't come up with the word. Perfect. Just like a writer. But from a writer's perspective, I was really admiring the very careful but beautiful escalation of his reaction and how much he was talking.
Yeah.
How in each successive scene when he would have these moments, it also involved him talking more. And more until we get to that scene that I'm not quite up to yet for a very specific reason.
Sure.
But that was really certainly entertaining. Speaking of entertaining, going to rewind the episode back a little bit because kind of there's one little thread that's been going on throughout the episode that I have not taken the time with. And it's actually one of my favorite aspects of the entire episode. I love the Pete Strickland character. He is my favorite character on the show. I think we actually talked about this last time as well. But if I wasn't sure beforehand, I was. I am absolutely sure with this episode. Because he's been tailing Detective Ennis all around town for days, whatever. I love the fact that Ennis actually spots him. And you think that scene's going to go a different way, and it doesn't go that way. I thought it was fascinating that he said, oh, let's talk. And he takes him to a whorehouse, of course, because he probably has heard that Pete has these predilections. But then, you know, we fast forward later when Pete has a scene with Perry, and we realize that, you know, Pete's just as much of a detective as Perry is, from what I've seen so far. He is genuinely doing the legwork here. And when he ticks off the things about Ennis that, you know, over the last, you know, how, number one, that how he arranged to get himself on the case, which we saw in that scene when he's talking to that other cop earlier, when they find, you know, at another random crime scene where it looks like some lady had died and probably had been dead for days. And I kept wondering about, what did the cat die of? Did the cat die of starvation? I mean, they don't make it clear. I'm curious. Or how Ennis showed up really super quick at the actual crime scene where the dead kidnappers were, or even more suspiciously, how he was able to show up at Gannon's house that was in an entirely different county out of his jurisdiction. You know, again, almost lightning fast, as though he was there waiting and prepared to do whatever tinkering needed to be done with the crime scene. I really enjoyed all that. And the fact that even though we saw from the very first episode, I mean, he's trying to make a couple bucks because he's got a family and a bunch of mouths to feed, and he gets screwed by Perry every once in a while. Oh, by the way, like any true PI, because we all know PIs never really get paid. Ask Jim Rockford. Yeah. I mean, I think there's like a, you know, there's 100-something episodes of the Rockford Files. I think he got paid maybe a dozen times. But the fact is that at this point, he's doing it because it's what's right.
Yeah. Well, and Ennis gives him the creeps. Like he really thinks Perry's onto something. And Ennis makes multiple mistakes that somebody who's a true scallywag like Pete knows are indications that you're really scum. And,
The fact that I was amazed that Ennis tried to deflect by kind of casting aspersions or even suspicions on his partner, who's the lead detective, Detective Holcomb. That was like, ooh, that's kind of interesting. That's not what I expect him to say. I do like also that they established that Pete was a cop once.
Yeah.
I don't think we knew that for sure. We might have guessed it, but we hadn't heard it for sure. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. And, if Pete was a crooked cop who realizes what he did wrong, he's keen on all of Ennis's ways. And, I hope either Pete or Drake get to end Ennis at some point, and they're the one that bring him down.
It'll happen.
I hope so.
It'll happen on the
It's stand. Delicious. Well, maybe, but that was another good little scene with little bits of information that, you know, there we learned about Pete's background. And when he tells Perry what his code, see, the thing about Pete I like is this, and I know you're hot. I'm sorry I'm going on, but this was a great episode and we loved it, is that Perry, Della, Drake are all these characters that are sort of changing. The thing we love about Pete is Pete's a constant, but he has a code. And Ennis broke that code. Like, we know who Pete is. Pete's not going to have a stunning revelation. He's sort of, and you see that at the end of the scene, like he doesn't jump right up when the girl sits next to him. Pete is who he is, but he does have a code, and we appreciate that about him.
Although the implication is he doesn't end up taking the whore, from what he said to Perry later on.
Which
in of itself may, if there is any quote unquote change at all to be found in Pete, because it's not like he wasn't an admirable person before, but like you said, scallywag, you know, a little bit of a scoundrel, but not evil, not a bad guy, just, you know, a little bit on the lecherous side. I'm one who can appreciate that. Let's just leave it at that. Anyway, you had to remind me about how hot it was in here. Meanwhile, and of course, I'm drinking lemonade that's got whiskey in it, so it's not really having the cool, refreshing effect on me as I drink.
Not
I'm,
lemonade, that cool, refreshing drink.
Anyway, that clinked rather loudly. So let's get to let's get to it here. So, as we saw in the scene with Lyle and Della, as we mentioned already, pretty much Della had come up with a list of 53 lawyers, but not one of them is going to take the case, as Lyle says. It's a preordained loser. And then we have that scene in the kitchen. And as I said before, we've seen an escalation of, you know, anger, frustration, etc. with Perry, culminating in a scene and when he's going off on everything about the case. And I was so pleased that I believe I was realizing at the very same, at almost tit for tat with Della, what's happening here. And I started, that was the first time in the episode, I mean, not the first time I started smiling in the episode, it happened a couple times, but I was like going, Oh, I see what they're doing. Huh. It's like, it's the epiphany. It's a little goofy, but I don't mind. It's the epiphany moment.
But you know what's great about it, in the way they did it, is that he's still talking, and she sits down and starts typing.
Oh, that's what made it great.
Because yes,
that you actually also had room for some comical moments at the same time, like when the woman who runs the house comes in and she tells Perry to offer her a drink, and you have all that stuff going on. Now here's the funny thing. So she's typing, whatever. I just did my that I just did Nicholson in The Shining. That's exactly like you hear me typing, or you don't hear me typing. Whatever the anyway. Here's the thing, and this is where I felt I loved the fact I felt stupid, because I don't want to be able to, call the shot all the time. I like being like surprised or whatever. And my initial thought is like, she's typing all this up. This is because I already know this is about, trying the case. Like, I don't know if she's, cut out the curse words, but I don't know if this is an opening statement. It's stating the case, whatever. And then we find out what she's actually doing when we see her forging, and the signature she's probably done a million times before, EB's signature. I love the angle her hand takes, whatever. It's really great.
Yeah, left-handed.
So, and this is the thing I meant to say early on, but I realized, I'll just say it when we get to it. Okay, that was not how I expected them to deal with how does Perry become a lawyer. And just to be clear, we all watched it, but, she forges a note from EB stating that Perry had been under his apprenticeship for the past 2.5 years, which would be, i.e. putting him on track to become a lawyer. And literally all that's left now is for him to take the bar in order to get his degree. And I'm not kidding. When I typed this, at the moment I realized what was happening, I read, wow, that's slicker than anything even Jimmy McGill could come up with right now. So
yeah, but Della, if you remember when they were in the when they were having the drink after delivering EB's body to his family, Perry says it's not about what's legal. Sometimes it's about what's right. And she. By the end of the episode, he's rubbed off on her a little bit that to save this woman, they can't do what's legal. They have to do what's right.
Right. I neglected to say it earlier. I meant to say it actually right around now, so now you said it, because that's kind of the mantra and the theme for this episode, possibly the series, because that's Perry's way of going about things, which, again, there's that weird slight little echo of, a certain Mr. McGill / Goodman, at least so far on a certain other show. Kind of reminds us, or maybe more Miss Wexler even. Mm-hmm. Probably more Wexler this past season. So I feel like we're already kind of attuned to this way of thinking, so to speak. But the fact is, he says it himself and he kind of delivers it, the line, kind of like that's one of, like I said, like it's his mantra. That's his way of viewing the world, which kind of like supersedes her referring to something as being cynical. Like, cause in a way it kind of, I think it surpasses cynicism. It's a matter of doing what's right, not necessarily what's legal. Then she says it later on in the episode. I think, does she say it when she's with her lover at the?
Yes.
Yes. She's talking.
Yes, because she's hiding the evidence, exactly. So that Dodson doesn't get it.
So yeah, the moment she's quoting him, you realize, she's for that way of thinking, hook, line, and sinker, which is fine. I just thought once this was happening, and I realized, oh my god, we're actually getting the quote unquote the origin of how Perry got his law degree or how he becomes a lawyer, and my dumbass theories about that he had a law degree before World War One and all. All right, out the door. Who cares? It's dumb crap. Doesn't matter. But what I felt like I should have realized maybe not from before the show started or even after the first episode, but at some point as we've been watching chapter after chapter, I should have known that Della would be playing a big part in that. I should have known that. And if there's one thing I'm kind of, I want to give myself a little slap about, it's like, you should have realized Delve is going to be would have to play a major part in this as far as how he becomes a lawyer on the show. So let me get to the thing that made me so very happy now. Not just this part, because guess what? Remember I said there were three things that got me choked up? That was the third one. When I realized this is how Perry becomes a lawyer, I got clumped again. Because, I'm a wuss.
I thought it was great.
So then we get to we're in the last minute or two of the series of the show of the episode now, and Perry is meeting some about to meet someone. I don't think he realizes he's going to meet someone, but meeting someone at the local diner or whatever it is. Guy sits down. He's very well dressed, well kept, and he starts talking about how he has a law degree, and at first we're thinking, oh, this is the guy who's going to help educate him about taking the bar. And I'm watching, and this, if I was upset at myself for not realizing that Della was going to play a part, a major part, in how Perry becomes a lawyer, I am ashamed of myself for forget. I think in the moment I realized who it was, but I should have realized it all well ahead of time. When he says his name, his name is Hamilton Berger. Now, if you know Perry Mason, i.e. the TV show, the books, you know who Hamilton Berger is. Kind of a big deal. Perfect. The fact that the guy, because just in case anyone who's listening to this podcast isn't aware of Hamilton Berger, that's very possible now that I think about it, 20-something, how would they know? Hamilton Berger was always the DA who was in opposition to Perry. They got along fine. They were like friendly adversaries, essentially. In the TV show, episode after episode, that's who Perry is up against. Hamilton Berger. In the books, that's the same thing. I love the idea that the guy who is going to be, for in the history of the character, going to be his chief adversary for hundreds and hundreds of cases is literally going to be the guy who helps him get his law degree.
Literally like the Washington Generals training the Harlem Globetrotters, who did go on and kick their ass over and over and over again.
Perfect analogy. Exactly. Because Hamilton Berger, we always like him, but yes, he's basically the Washington Generals. Perfect. Exactly. Dead on. And also, the fact, although I don't think he ever appeared on Boardwalk Empire, I do recognize the actor. It's Justin Kirk. A lot of people, the main thing people remember him from more than anything else is probably Weeds. Because he played, he was a major character, the brother on that show throughout. I know he's been on a bunch of other things, some dramas as well as sitcoms, whatever. But he's actually a very good actor. I mean, I've always been a fan of him. And my only regret with this episode is because obviously they did kind of a smash cut to two weeks later, or 2+ weeks later, I guess, because they mentioned at the bar. He could take the bar in 2 weeks and he'd have to study for it. And we smash cut to Perry essentially taking the oath, with all his other new fellow lawyers. My regret is that, oh, wait, I hope that's not, is this the only little moment we're going to get with Hamilton Berger? I mean, it still becomes like a cool cameo, but I almost kind of wanted to see more interactions between them. I love he just begins by giving like some sort of like, it's almost like a math example, where I guess it would be like a legal scenario about a guy in a bait shop or something, whatever it is. I kept thinking how much I would enjoy an entire episode of just that. I know we don't have time in the show. It's only 8 episodes and whatever. So they really fast-tracked Perry becoming a lawyer, by the way.
They did. And the questions get answered quickly. I will say I have some hope if the show goes on that by the nature of the actor they picked, they could have picked you didn't want to pick a leading man type for that role, but the actor they picked is recognizable and well enough known that but not too famous that he could could go on and play Hamilton Burger in maybe next season or whatever. So it gives me hope that based on that actor's choice, there may be a possibility of a future season.
I absolutely agree. I have not, again, because I have not really read much about the show since it's been airing. So I don't know what the situation is as far as whether there is thought to doing a second season or not. I don't know what the reception or the ratings have been for the show, and I have no idea. That's not like I couldn't have read any of that stuff. It wouldn't interfere with the podcast because we're doing like an immediate reaction podcast anyway. Plus, it's nice to be informed sometimes. I just haven't gotten around. I've just been busy. But I agree with everything you just said. Justin Kirk, he's kind of one of those guys, solid supporting guy. He's been, like I said, he's been like the supporting guy in dramas, whatever. I think he's been like the main character. I think he was the main character in like a really ridiculously bad sitcom. It was one with he's a vet or something with animals from a few years ago. It was just one of those goofy things you would see on the bottom of the screen on NBC. And like, is anyone going to watch it? Like Animal Practice or some crappy title like that. I can't remember. But I like the actor. I've seen him be in a number of things. I would love a show. It does not have to, if they do a second season, it does not have to be classic Perry Mason. It does not, especially if it's on HBO. I don't expect it to be a procedural. I expect it to be a one case for the entire season. Maybe there might be a second case that we clear up in the very first episode or something, kind of like the Fatty Arbuckle thing in this season with Perry. I would love them to do it. Oh, one last little thing I want to say about the episode. After he passes the bar and takes the oath, and then we go right to the end credits. I'm just going to say I got a kick out of the end credits because the end credits for the show, at least the initial minute or so, tend to have some imagery, usually. Most of them have had the same images, but I think they might have changed them a little bit in some episodes. But this one certainly was different. And we see things dealing with, the scales of justice and Lady Justice and whatever, which is very, very, very reminiscent of, at a certain point during the run of the Perry Mason show, I can't remember, I don't know the show well enough to remember what season it was or how many seasons they did it for. That was very reminiscent of one of the opening title sequences for the original Perry Mason show. I think later in its run, I think in its early one, the images are just like Perry in court and, and putting files down in front of each of the characters and whatever. But I think at some point later on, they had these images, that were kind of like, especially like in diagonals and whatever of Lady Justice and the scales. I was like, oh, I wonder if they're kind of having a little wink and a nod to the TV show, or it's just such obvious basic imagery. Maybe it's not, but I kind of think it is personally.
I thought it was I think it's a wink, especially with the proximity to the Hamilton Burger cameo. So.
Yes, exactly. And I like I said from the get-go, I really liked this episode a lot, and I'm not surprised that I liked the episode a lot because I've liked every episode a lot. But maybe because we got a huge question I've had since the show started answered, and I liked the fact that it wasn't what I had anticipated, and I even thought it was amusing how fast they got it resolved, because, we go within 5 minutes, hey, Perry could be a lawyer, and Perry's a lawyer. But they pulled it off in a way where it wasn't really that ridiculous, and it's like, okay. And the fact you could have that an episode I liked that much, and we didn't have practically, we had, other than his voice on a phone, we really didn't have Stephen Root in the episode, who usually is good for a couple scenes of fun scenery chewing or whatever. So it's definitely one of my favorite episodes of the first five so far.
Yeah, I agree with that. Really loved it. And I will say that the episode threaded the needle between your theory and mine. I had actually suggested possibly Perry had apprenticed, and unknowingly he was, but he actually, EB wasn't actually using him as an apprentice, and Della forged it and came up with it, which is a brilliant twist, and loved it, thought it moved it really forward. Now who knows what's going to happen next episode with him being sworn in. So looking forward to next week's episode.
My only prediction is that Perry will start being clean shaven.
I'd say you're right.
Pretty sure
he's probably dressed a little better and not drink as much.
Well, we'll see about the drinking.
He may just move to a madman level of drinking, not, you know.
Oh, well, that I'm sorry. That would mean he's going to drink a whole lot more.
But only after 5 p.m.
Only after 5, you know. Gotcha. Alrighty then. So, kids and kiddies out there, if you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and join the conversation about shows, I don't know, like Perry Mason, like the mentioned frequently Better Call Saul. It's probably our favorite show to talk about there, and many others. You can track us down on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever it's called nowadays. You know, find us there, Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed, and you can rate and review us. I can't seem to get in there anymore, so I don't know. Maybe we've gotten hundreds of more reviews in the last few weeks. We haven't. Better still, you can just go to our major archive of all our podcasts. You go to our host page or the folks who host us at podbean.com. It's stvdpodcast.podbean.com. And you can check out all 260, this will be 263, so 263 podcasts. Like I say every time, there's actually a couple of good ones in there. Not that many, but there's a few. And finally, what do I usually end with? Oh, Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. STVD as in Serious TV Drama. Okie dokie. We will definitely, number one, be back next week with the next Perry Mason podcast. Ooh, I like that alliteration, Perry Mason podcast. That will be chapter 6. There is a chance, depending on it's more your schedule, because you have an extremely busy life dealing with, you know, the league, you know, your job in Kentucky there as your lawyering and such. And I know there's a much better way to put that. I'm sorry, it's after midnight. I've lost
it's okay.
The articulate. So when Brian, when I know that you have a spare hour and change, I am twisting your head. I'm going to blame you, even though I'm not really blaming you. But we are going to eventually do a Doom Patrol podcast. May only just be one. Might be two. But I'm just saying. And the fact that now I've already saved the music for the opening and closing, and I've prepared the image for the podcast. It's like the only thing I haven't done is written anything down yet. And that's not going to take me that long, because you know, you can sit back for the first like 5 to 7 minutes while I just give everyone the history of the Doom. No, I'm not going to take that long to do that. But yeah, I'm really excited to do a podcast, at least one, if not two, podcast about the Doom Patrol. It even has a little bit of alliteration there too. Patrol podcast, Doom podcast. We'll figure it out. Really want to do that. Looking forward to all the podcasts. I don't have to do a debt. No, I kid. That's not true. He'll never hear this, I hope.
Well, I look forward to that, too. I'm the victim of my own suggestion, having urged you to watch it, and I'm glad you love it, and I look forward to talking about it.
Yeah, my hope is that in a perfect world, we'll knock one off that'll be a major one, because we've got, you know, a season and a half. Or season and three quarters, whatever to talk about. And then maybe we do one around the time when it ends. Or maybe we'll do one. Who knows? Well, it depends on our schedules, because I don't want to put too much on it. But it's going to happen.
So watch Doom Patrol, kids. It's awesome.
Yes, because otherwise it'll be like, you know, the only people who will be downloading the podcast will be people who automatically download it. Like, I don't want to listen to those. Or, you know what? I'll tell them to listen to it anyway, because I'll make it so entertaining it won't matter if they've never watched it. That's
right. Exactly.
That's right, because I'm going to cover every single episode. No, I already have a plan. I have a plan. Believe it or not. I'll have a clock. We're going to... going to be like, it's going to be like a 2 to 3 minute per episode thing. And it's going to be amazing. People will be entertained for years. Anyway. So.
Definitive.
Right. It'll be the definitive Doom Patrol podcast. Arnold Drake will rise from the dead. And actually, is he dead? Yeah, Arnold Drake is dead. Probably no one knows who Arnold Drake is. I'll shut up. He created the Doom Patrol. Anyway, wow, I am sweating so much right now. Okay, that's it for tonight. So, Brian, once again, thank you so much for joining me for this podcast. I hope everybody out there enjoys listening to it as much as I think we enjoy talking about Perry Mason and being on this podcast. And once again, I will let you say goodnight last. I'll just say goodnight to you and goodnight to everybody out there.
Good night, everyone. Have a great week.